Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Mark Dubin from Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we will be discussing the article, Assessing Adequacy of Surgical Extent in Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyposis, the Completion of Surgery Index, which was published in January 2025. I'm joined by first author, Dr. Alan Workman from Mass Eye and Ear in Boston, and the senior author, Dr. Jin Palmer from University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Welcome, Alan and Jim, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the publication.
Thanks, Mark. It's really a privilege to be here. And I do want to highlight that this was a group effort we put together. I mean, Alan, first author, appropriately so, really spearheaded the whole project because it came out of a day when we were in the OR talking about chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps and how surgeries really do make a difference.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here. This definitely stemmed out of a bunch of different conversations. And I know Jim's been thinking about this for many years. And so he finally found a willing victim to help try to spearhead it and carry it through.
I was going to say, Alan, it took you to bring it across the finish line.
Great. So my choice of this article, which is usually how I start these, is describing why I picked them. It initially stemmed from a side conversation that Jim and I had at an SAB meeting for a company that remained nameless. The conversation was about biologics and the role that completion surgery should play in patients with CRS with polyposis based on our experience as tertiary care rhinologists. For those of us who spend most of our time doing revision surgery, it is clear that a surgery that is more than adequate in many patients is not quote-unquote complete enough in others. Furthermore, quote-unquote completing the surgery in these patients, which often is enlarging a frontal outflow with a draft 2B or draft 3, significantly improves the ability to control inflammatory disease with topical medications that have failed in the same patients previously. Therefore, a true quantitative measure of completeness to objectify what most of us do subjectively has the potential to significantly impact our ability to manage our patients. So now that I'm done with my verbal diarrhea, what led you guys to pick this topic?
Big picture, it encompasses a huge chunk of my career. As you said, Mark, we end up doing revision surgery. We quote, open things up bigger. But as I kept doing it over and over, I realized what I really was doing was changing the philosophy of, quote, FESS or ESS. So the philosophy when I started in 2000 and finished my fellowship 2001 and got started at Penn was you're draining the sinuses. And it's not really by 2006 or 7 when Alex Chu and I started irrigating people with budesonide in the Neomed bottle. It changed actually what we were doing. I'm not actually opening sinuses to have them drain. I'm opening sinuses so I can put topical therapies in. And once you make that mental change, it actually does change the way you're doing surgery. And so the basis of the COSI, the Completion of Surgery Index, was to try and figure out a way to put a number on the fact that we're doing a surgery designed for irrigation. And I'll keep coming back to that over and over again, which is every last polyp patient I do goes on steroid irrigation or the OptiNose EDOS fluticasone spray. So without question, everybody has to go to some augmented delivery of steroid to their sinus cavities.
And just to piggyback off what Jim's saying, I think that the time was really ripe for better understanding, you know, not just, revision surgery, but also quality of surgery. And how do you assess that? How do you assess if enough has been done? You know, for better or for worse, we have different options for polyp patients now. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we're not jumping to a biologic therapy too quickly in a patient who has had an insufficient surgical therapy. So before, you know, you would have no choice but to just continue doing FESS. Here, we want to better understand those patients who can be best treated by us and who hasn't yet received enough treatment to warrant ramping up to something as drastic as a biologic.
And a quick way to cut through that, I have a slide in my slide deck when I'm talking about this now that the ENT says why to the allergist, why are you starting a biologic after one partial surgery? And the allergist says to the ENT, why are you operating on a nasal polyp patient five times? And so I think both of those things are true. There is a place where maybe we should be stopping to operate. And there's definitely a place where we need to figure out what the right amount of surgery is. And the scoring system's our attempt to do it.
So just to get started on the actual manuscript and the research, I mean, there are numerous CT grading systems that exist. You know, why do we need another one? I mean, you mentioned it, but do the ones that exist not address this? You know, what shortfalls in the current systems are addressed by by the cut?
So the Lund-Mackay score, which obviously we've been using for a long time now, it certainly makes sense for some assessment of disease burden, but it doesn't really assess what's been accomplished surgically. You can have people with very open cavities that you know, still have polyposis, but may benefit from topical irrigations because they're functionally open. Whereas, you know, the Lund-Mackay score doesn't really cut into what's actually been done. So it just assesses disease at a snapshot in time. One of the things that we love about the COSI is it's static over time because we're really looking at bony surgical anatomy. And so you're not going to have a different COSI score, even if you get CTs that are, you know, at different points in time. And so it allows you to assess something a little bit more objectively than with the Lund-Mackay score.
So shifting gears a little bit, so let's get into the meat of the manuscript. So can you describe the methods and, you know, specifically what the scoring system is and how it came about?
Let me take the first run of this and then Alan will follow in because he did a lot of the nuts and bolts and I did some of the big picture. And part of the big picture for me was that we have one of those little Zorian scanners in our office, which means it's really easy for me to get a post-op scan. And I will tell you, there is nothing more humbling than getting a post-op scan on a patient you operated on because you go, oh man, I suck. Well, maybe not suck, but you realize where you missed it and you weren't as good as you thought you were. And it makes you a significantly better surgeon. So I've been doing that for the last 20 some years in my office. So when Al and I were talking about this and said, we need to figure a better system, so on and so forth, I said to him, you know, I got a ton of patients that I've done their surgery and I've done post-op scans on them. So we've got before surgery and after surgery. And yes, I blew it a bunch of those times, but then sometimes I even have a third scan on there because I did another surgery. Revise my own work. Thankfully, that's not that often. And we've got the scan from that. So we said, hey, let's use that as our baseline fodder for coming up with how to create a scoring system. So this thing was done from scratch. And Alan sat in on that scanner and he went over every set of scans and really did more just taking notes and thinking about things and then came back to me. So let me hand it over to Alan from there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we certainly didn't just start off with a scoring system pre-made and then started going through scans. What I really was trying to assess was, you know, looking at 100 polyp patients, looking at pre-op scans, looking at post-op scans, and taking notes about all of the different aspects of the bony anatomy that was changed with surgery to get a sense of what we were doing on our patients, how much we were doing, how much openings you could achieve, and then, you know, taking all the clinical data with that as well. So looking at the SNOT-22 score. So when we initially had the notes on these first 100 patients, we were looking at a lot of different parameters, some of which aren't even included in the COSI score, and some of which are more granular than the COSI score. And it wasn't until we had a couple iterations of this that we started to really nail down the things that we thought were important, that we were seeing recurring as patterns, things that we thought could be really nicely objectively quantified, and things that we thought mattered from some of our previous understanding of where irrigations are getting to. And so it was a very iterative process. And I think that we both learned a lot, you know, about how to develop something in that time.
So what is the score? Can you explain it to the listeners?
Jim's part was, Alan, it's got to be on 100 points because I friggin' hate the SNOT-22 is out of these scoring systems that are out of 24 points or 68 points and all over the place. They just don't speak to me. So my first parameter was it's got to be 100 points is everything you could possibly do and 0 points is nothing. And then we build it from there. Go ahead, Alan. Yep.
And so with that mandate, I mean, obviously I had all this incredibly granular data. So I was like, okay, this gets 0 points. This gets 2 points, 3 points, 7 points. And I realized very quickly that we were creating an incredibly complex scoring system, and we were getting away from what we wanted to achieve was, you know, a grade that gives you an outcome. Did this patient have good enough surgery, and putting a number on that? And so what we realized is that we could, you know, isolate the four sinuses, the maxillary, ethmoid, sphenoid, and frontal, 50 points on each side. You get a maximum of 10 points for each of those sinuses, and we'll go get a little bit more into the granular details of that. And then there was this last category, that those final 20 points, 10 points on each side, where you can look at things like a draft 3 frontal sinusotomy. You can look at middle turbinates, which is oftentimes middle turbinectomy or partial middle turbinectomy, is something that we think about for our polyp patients. And so that really nicely fit into this score of 100. And so to get into the details of that, 0 points, very simply, the maxillary is untouched, the ethmoid is untouched, the sphenoid is untouched, 0 points for a frontal is untouched, or we all know the sinusotomy where maybe you get a tiny probe up there but haven't really done any dissection. That's all 0 points. To get the 5 points for each of the sinuses, that's with an antrostomy in the maxillary, a sphenoidotomy in the sphenoid, and again, this is visible on CT. For the frontal, you're looking at a draft 2A, so you've done certainly a good amount of dissection, but haven't necessarily completed the maximum frontal dissection in that location. And then lastly, for the ethmoid, where we had the most consternation trying to figure out how do you quantify the ethmoid, what we were finding again and again and again was that when complete cells were remaining in the ethmoid, either the posterior or anterior ethmoid cavity, we were seeing a lot more high SNOT 22 scores, patients who were symptomatic. So the 5 points means some complete cells remain. We looked at partitions, we looked at, is it in the anterior ethmoid, the posterior ethmoid? And ultimately we settled on, if there are any complete cells that remain, then you only get 5 points on the ethmoid cavity.
I'm going to jump in there for 1 second, because you mentioned that you don't include partial ethmoid partitions or septal deviation. Can you, I mean, because honestly, a lot of what we do is, that's a lot of revision sinus surgery, or you know, partial ethmoid partitions and revision septum. So explain absolutely why that doesn't fit in there.
Absolutely. So Jim and I were both looking at this. We had the septum, we had deviated septum in the original notes that we were taking on the CTs, really looking at that. We just did not find that the septal deviation was really what was leading to, you know, a lot of these patients requiring revision surgery or having high SNOT 22 scores. Certainly, it's another aspect of nasal anatomy that can contribute to sensation of obstruction, but we did not see that as important for these polyp patients specifically. And then to your point about the ethmoid partitions, it's really, you know, trying to figure out, can you get the irrigations, as Jim mentioned, into these cavities? And when there's ethmoid partitions and everything else is relatively open, the irrigation does ostensibly hit a lot of those areas. When you have complete cells, that's really where you're finding, you know, the irrigation access is not there. And so that's where Jim and I kind of decided to make that division. And if he has anything else to say, you know, enlightening on that, I think we can talk about it. But getting more granular in the ethmoid, we felt like we may be losing the details and losing the utility of the score.
And so let's talk about that septum part, because I've been quoted at many a sinus course about how septum's really important. You know, you forget about the septum. You got to do a good septum. Well, you know what? It just didn't come out in the score. And the more I think about it, the more I realized it's because we set up our score for patients irrigating, one, and two, they were nasal polyp patients. So those two things together, as I keep saying to my patients over and over, it's a flood, not a fountain shooting in your nose. So when you're flooding your sinuses, the deviation of the septum, if it's not just like wonked over, totally blocking, which I think everybody fixes anyway on their first case, it doesn't matter because the flood still gets there. So that's why those SNOT 22s still come out pretty good, which is why the septum's not in there. And the other thing about the septum was every time we tried to then quantify the septum, how deviated is it? That was really hard on those CT scans too, to jam people into that box. So that's how the septum got thrown out. And I think Alan did a great job covering the ethmoid differences. And then the last thing I'll say, when you start thinking about it big picture, that I like is, if you do a good job, maxillary, ethmoid, sphenoid, you're already at 60 points. And the real question here is, why is the frontal sinus so overloaded? The frontal sinus area is so overloaded because that's where those patients go bad first. Anybody that's seen a bunch of patients, done a bunch of surgery, knows the first place things go bad is the frontal recess. And so that's the place that we front loaded our score.
So I'm going to jump in with that also, because to your point, the frontal is obviously critical in these patients, and delivery medication is critical. And your scoring is a bony scoring system, which obviously is appropriate, but there is scarring that occurs in the frontal, you know, soft tissue scarring that can obliterate, yet, you know, with, particularly when drilling is done. So can you comment how a draft 2A, 2B, 3, that it has a bony opening but is completely scar closed, you know, falls well, in, isn't that much of an issue?
I think you're nitpicking the one small area of our setup that isn't perfect, but I still like it anyway. Yeah, what about the scarred frontal that looks clean on bone? Does that go to, I still think those patients benefit from surgery. This isn't saying they don't benefit from surgery or their surgery isn't done. It's, all right, that patient you need to think about a biologic for, because, you know, when you look at our numbers, and Alan, of course, was happy to point out that I did a revision on somebody who already had a cosi of 100, and I did it again. So,
and that patient didn't get much improvement.
But some of those people still need it. And that person did not get his, it didn't get their bump in the SNOT 22. So they were a little bit better off, but not much, which is exactly what we're trying to show. So I was actually glad for that to some extent.
All right, so shifting gears to the findings. So what do you guys consider the most important findings that came out of this?
So overall, when we set out to do this, we asked the question, can we find a cosi score that represents enough surgery where you can say, okay, this patient has actually had a pretty adequate surgical intervention, and maybe we should start thinking about other therapies, and conversely, identifying the patients who haven't had enough. And so that was a real big driver for us, is figuring out, is there a cutoff in this cosi score that's going to correlate with quality of life outcomes? And can we utilize this and look at our patients in that way? And so it was, you know, the most impactful finding was really this cutoff around a cosi score of 70, which again is not perfect and it doesn't need to be perfect. And I think that Jim really emphasized that, you know, there is enough surgery and there's a lot of different ways to get points on this and to open up enough sinuses. But what we found was actually a pretty hard cutoff where the patients who had a cosi score below 70 were really improving after a revision surgery from a SNOT 22 perspective, with huge improvements in SNOT 22 that are well above the minimal important clinical difference, you know, three times the clinical difference. And then some patients who were above 70, and the vast majority of the patients who were above 70, when they got revision surgery, they just did not see as much of a bump. And so helping us to identify these patients, you know, that haven't had enough surgery, but also those who have had enough. And so I think it gives us a balanced view of who might benefit from biologics and who we shouldn't be skipping to biologics to.
So obviously Alan's answer covered it beautifully. I'm going to go back to it a little bit differently, in that when the biologics were coming down the pike, I was president of the ARS and I put together a working group to say, you know, to write something which is in IFAR about how we should be looking at nasal polyps. And Zach Soler was one of the people that was on that group. And I still remember him sitting in that meeting room saying, we haven't taken on the completeness of surgery and we all know it really matters. At least in our review of it, it said exactly that we don't have data on completeness of surgery, but that must be considered before you start getting to do a biologic. If you look at the two European studies or consensus statements, they say in them, we don't know how to do the difference of completeness of surgery, therefore we won't look at it. But then the papers that they reference then point out that if you don't do a complete surgery, you're more likely to have a revision surgery, which to me is a definition of failure. So where am I going with this whole thing? The idea was, let's have a guiding principle for people. When you have somebody that's had their polyps regrow or shows up in your office with disease, you get a scan before you decide what you're going to do. If their surgery is not complete to a certain point, that 70 point that Alan mentioned, those people will benefit and get a bigger bump in their SNOT 22 from getting a surgery and going with irrigation than they will with a biologic. And that goes right against the Liberty 24 and 52 studies. All the biologic studies combined, all of it, best they get is around a bump of 20 in their SNOT 22. And we're getting a bump of a 24, 25 in their SNOT 22. So that to me is a pretty obvious line in the sand. Now, the next piece is the people who we did surgery again on who were had a 70 and we still took them to surgery. I always want to point out that that doesn't mean they didn't improve. They improved, but about a 14. So I don't know where we would be if we took people who'd had a complete surgery and put them on biologics. What would their bump in SNOT 22 be? Just not sure. And I think at some point we're going to get that study finding also. One more thing that I want to point out, not in this paper, but in papers to come, because you always have to put out that teaser for where we're going. It turns out if your COSI is less than 70 and you get surgery and irrigation, your asthma control test bumps better than if you went on a biologic, which to me is fascinating. And it goes back to the old story we always used to talk about. If your sinuses are bad, it's a unified airway. Clean up the sinuses, and a lot of times the asthma will improve.
So I do want to repeat what you said just for our listeners, because it was, while the development of the indexes and the scoring system is important enough, in there, in your data, is that what we've all been trying to assess, and you said it already, was that people who had incomplete surgery and then had complete surgery did better, or this at least as well as people who were put on biologics, which is what we you have objectively shown that with the data that you presented, which I think is really important. I mean, it's an important point in and of itself, you know, to point out for our listeners.
And it was also durable over 2 years, which I think is a, is another important part of the data where you can see that improvement over a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, we've got 2 year follow up and our biologic friends are at 1 year at best. But I do want to stick one more piece in there when you say that, Mark, because I agree with you. Thank you for picking it out and saying it so nicely for us. But there has to be a follow up of steroid irrigation or EDOS fluticasone afterwards. You can't just do surgery in a vacuum and stop treating it. You know, so in some ways, you're instead of a biologic chronically, you're irrigating chronically, which in my mind has so many less side effects potentially and so much less trouble. But I guess maybe that's where the patient choice comes into it. There's certainly a difference in price. And so that's kind of where I see things, that we've got to get ourselves to the point also as surgeons that people always follow with steroid topical use and not just a simple spray. It's got to be the EDS fluticasone or irrigation.
So one thing I'd like to ask is, you know, your patient population at Penn, which is likely to be up there with the worst of the worst, affects, does this affect the applicability of this index to the broader population in your minds, or you think it's pretty applicable?
In my mind, it means that you're probably going to do even better, because of our 100 cohort, as we dice into that group, 25 of them are AERD. So they're aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, the worst of the worst. And we're still beating the biologics with that. And they went on aspirin desensitization to go with their irrigations. And also, you know, people always keep coming back and ask me, well, what's the actual use of biologics in the Penn setup? And, you know, I can't tell you where it is everywhere else in the world, but I can tell you our numbers because we've looked at them really closely. And it's about 10%. And thank God for that 10%. When I showed up at Penn, about 10% of the people were on prednisone, 10 milligrams every other day. And we know that that tears up your body in the long term. And so these biologics are incredible gifts for that patient population. It's that patient population, which in our hands is 10% of everybody we see. And I would challenge the rest of the world that, as you said, we're dealing with mainly revision cases that have a lot of disease. And if we're at 10%, I'm not sure that you need to be more than that. And when I say 10%, obviously for every 100 patients, it may be 15, and the next 100, it may be 8, and the next 100, it may be 21. You know, there's, it's that 10 to 15%-ish or 5 to 10%-ish percentage that gets thrown around when people talk about big interventions in medicine.
So my next question, I'm going to ask each of you to address it because you're both at very different stages in your career. How do you use the, you know, the COSI at this point? You know, do you use it, you know, if someone is greater than 70? I mean, Alan alluded to it. You guys both alluded to it a little bit earlier. You know, people who come or who have greater than 70 or someone about 100. But, you know, you guys, you have access. You've been using this and have access to it for a lot longer than the rest of us who are just learning about it. So to tell me about how it works into your guys' practice, I'm going to let Alan start as the newbie coming out with this, you know, with this on his radar.
Absolutely. Yep. So I've been in practice for 9 months now. Using the COSI score has really, I've incorporated it tremendously because I do see a lot of revision rhinology referrals with people with polyposis from all over Massachusetts and New England. And I use it to kind of ground myself as to where they're at in their journey, because we meet patients at completely different stages of their journey all the time. Some people have had 10 sinus surgeries before, and some people have had kind of one balloon sinuplasty and then show up at your doorstep. And so really grounding yourself as to where they are in that with the COSI score gives you a really adequate picture of what's going on. If they've been on steroid irrigations, and they have a good COSI score, that's a completely different patient than a patient who's never heard the word budesonide or mometasone and someone who had a balloon sinuplasty. And so it's really where I start with in these poly patients. And that's been tremendously useful for me to assess who can I really help with another intervention? And then who should I, even if I am going to do surgery, you know, maybe they're at a 60, 65, who should I pay really close attention to, make sure they're seeing my allergy immunology colleagues as well, make sure we have a good multidisciplinary handle on them. And I think it's helped me identify those patients who are likely to improve versus less likely to improve.
Alan covered it beautifully. So what do I do with it now to add to what Alan's doing? Now I'm fortunate. I have that scanner in my office that the COSI was created off of, right? So I'll get their scan and I'll sit them down beside me and I'll pull up a patient that was a COSI of 20 before surgery and a COSI of 100 after surgery, and they'll see the difference, and they see the gray gone, and they see that they're irrigating great, and they'll easily look at it and go, I want that, right? And then I'll also get a scan on somebody who's got a lot of gray who had a pretty good surgery, and I'll say, look, here's somebody that had the huge bump from surgery. You haven't had as big a bump. I think the question for you is, do we start you on a biologic now and see where it goes and then do surgery if it doesn't do what we want? Or do we do surgery irrigation and then do a biologic if that doesn't hold? And one of the things that when I do it that way with them comes out every now and then is, well, Dr. Palmer, got to be honest with you, I didn't really irrigate very well for a while. And then I smile and say, what do you want to do? And some of them will say, let's go surgery and I'll be dedicated to my irrigations and we'll see where it goes. And some of them have done really, really well. Some of them have gotten kicked to a biologic a little sooner. That's the other thing that I think that this is helpful for, is that it helps me decide to kick somebody over to a biologic a little quicker. Because if you look at our average time to starting a biologic is a little bit over a year, close to 2 years, because we get them wide open, perioperative steroids, then start them irrigating. And the ones that slowly go down and get worse are the ones that maybe we should have started a biologic a little sooner on. And this COSI information can help us do that. I was just in Switzerland giving some of these talks, and, you know, it's interesting. No matter how you look at this, it doesn't answer the one thing we really want, which is how are patients going to do after surgery? It's helpful because we saw how they did after surgery based on their COSI, but it doesn't really tell us who are the ones that are going to do well and fly and who are the ones that aren't going to do as well and fly. But this, you know, we'll see where this goes. That's the next index that I would love to have exist. I'm just not sure how to do it.
This leads to my desire to express my ambivalence about how both Medicare and commercial insurance carriers may approach such a measure. Since I, for better or worse, spend a fair bit of time on patient and provider advocacy, while carriers have chosen random CT metrics to allow or disallow surgical interventions, this index has potential to either improve the situation or make it much more challenging if misused. An example of this would be a patient who has a diagnosis of CRS with pulposis, a cosi above 70, with a still suboptimally open frontal or sphenoid from soft tissue narrowing, or just simply filled with polyps who would benefit from surgery regardless. What are your thoughts on this? It's obviously hard to predict the future.
I think it's actually going to help us a lot. And the reason why I think it's going to help us a lot is that there's a lot more patients with incomplete surgery than there are with patients who had a good surgery that are still having trouble, to sort of be blunt. And what's the alternative for the ones who've had a good surgery that are still having trouble? It's biologics anyway, which cost far more than surgery. So do I see a day when the insurer looks at your CT scan and say your cosi is less than 70, you have to have surgery before you start a lifelong biologic? I cheer for that day because I think that's the right thing for our patients. You know, it's funny. I love to use this quote from Dave Shuler, who was the chief at Ohio State when I was a medical student there. And this was in the early 90s when there were one of a million fights over, oh my gosh, medical care is going into problems, so on and so forth. Back then, it was worries about everybody being shoved into an HMO. And he said to the group of residents, and I was with him sitting around, he said, just always do with the right thing for the patient, and the rest of it seems to work out. And that's kind of the way I feel about this cosi. I don't think it's going to go the wrong way because ultimately it is really all about the patient. It's about getting the right surgery for the patient.
But what about the one who has a 72 but needs surgery? Yeah. That's more.
But remember,
my concern is the denial.
Yeah, I agree. So they get denied. What are they going to get then? They're going to get biologics, which are going to cost a lot more for the insurance company. So I don't think that's going to happen. I'm less likely to see it. If you think of it from an insurance standpoint, they're doing this to save money, right? So right now they're doing it to just deny all surgery. But then once they look at their numbers, I had a fight with Blue Cross Blue Shield in the Independence area a few years ago. And ultimately it came down to the fact that sinusitis patients were one of their most expensive patients. And they wanted to figure out how to bring that number down. Well, more biologics is not the way to bring that number down.
And I think just to piggyback off a little bit of that, I think the era is, it's time for us to be good stewards of our surgery as well. I think, you know, especially as trained rhinologists, we understand what a good surgery looks like. And so being proactive about this and defining this so that we understand where we play a role and where biologics might play a role, it's much better for us to be a leading part of this conversation than for everything to come down the pipeline and for the insurance companies or the carriers to tell us what a complete surgery is. So, you know, if we can do this from a data-driven perspective, I think, you know, those smaller edge cases obviously are still important for us to think about. But overall, I think we're heading in a very positive direction with this from where we are now.
All right. So, Mark, you haven't asked the question, but I will for it, and then I'll answer it, which is, how do I know the cosi is going to be a success? I know it's going to be a success when we're in a meeting in the ARS or somewhere else, and there's panelists that had nothing to do with Alan or me, and they're presenting a case, and someone says, well, what was the cosi score to get an idea of what surgery they'd had to help them understand what surgery they need to do and give their opinion? And that's my dream.
I think you're getting there. I think you are. It's a good, I'm very, very excited about it, which is why I picked this article, and I'm glad we're talking about it. So what limitations in your study are there that you think are worth pointing out?
There's never a limitation in any study that's got my name on it, Mark. I'm, of course, kidding. Alan, go ahead. Rip it apart.
No, I mean, I think one of the biggest limitations is that, you know, we're looking just at the polyposis cohort. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of patients suffering with chronic rhinosinusitis, and it's one of the things that we've thought about forever. But obviously, we started with just polyp disease. So the applicability in patients with other types of disease, may not be there. Those are many future studies that would need to be done. The reason we chose polyps was obviously the severity of disease, the frequency of revision surgery, and the fact that we have biologics, which is an alternative treatment for it. But overall, you know, you're really looking at this more narrow patient population. And so that's one of the limitations. And then the other limitation is that, you know, we have to figure out a way to make the, you know, the scoring system more ubiquitously adopted, you know, perhaps even by radiology, the same way we have histopathology read by our pathologist, where you look at eosinophilia and neutrophilia. The standardization of something like this with a radiology colleagues would be really, really important. And so that's one of the things that, you know, is really key to the future of this, you know, being something important, is if we can get buy-in from us, you know, not just rhinologists, not just ENTs, but also radiologists and allergists and the other people who are all the involved stakeholders.
How long does it take to do? And are you doing it routinely for clinical purposes or just research purposes on your patients at this point?
I'm doing it routinely on my patients, you know, certainly calculating when I'm looking at their CT, especially when I'm meeting a new patient who's considering revision surgery. In terms of how long it takes me, it's about 30 seconds at this point. You know, I think Jim had alluded to the ability to kind of scroll through very quickly. But, you know, overall, it's one of those things that you have to learn how to do it. And we have a very easy scoring guide and things like that. But adopting something like this, just like the same way you would look at a CT before you do surgery and look at, you know, the Keras classification and where are the optics and things like that, you're looking at a CT in the same analytical way. And so we want to make sure that we're teaching people how to do it correctly.
Jim, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm doing it on every patient. And you can knock it out in about 30 seconds. What you do is you sit down on your, whatever way you have your CT scan, get to your axials first, and just real quick run down and look at your sphenoids. You can see if they're more than 70% open or not. And at the same time, you're seeing your maxillaries. You see those is open 70% or not. Then you flip it over to the coronals, go through the slices to see whether there's any complete cells in the ethmoid. That'll give you the answer quick. You look at the middle turbinates, whether there's some amputation or not, easy to see, and then look at your frontals. And I can knock that out in about 30 seconds. Now, obviously, I've been doing it a bunch, but my partners who had not done this, that we said, okay, you got to read all these scans for us if you want your name on the paper, because we got to be able to demonstrate inter-rater reliability. Our inter-rater reliability was under 5 points, number one. And number two, they were all able to do it. Now, they are trained rhinologists, so on and so forth.
So thank you guys for joining me. This was a great discussion. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. Lastly, as this is my final podcast, I'd like to thank the Scope It Out listeners for tolerating me over the last 2.5 years. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and the lively discussions, despite the occasional editing snafu. And I look forward to continuing to participate and Scope It Out as an avid listener. With that said, this is Mark Dubin for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, signing off.